This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Murdered U.S. journalist James Foley will be remembered this evening at Marquette University. His alma mater will hold a public vigil for the 1996 graduate at the Church of the Jesu at 11th and Wisconsin. Foley was executed last week by militants from the Islamic State organization, which had taken him hostage nearly 2 years ago as he attempted to cover the conflict in Syria. They had reportedly demanded a ransom from the United States in exchange for Foley's life before abruptly killing him last week. The turmoil in Syria is also on the mind of Lake Effect's foreign policy contributor. Art Sear, who teaches political economy and world business at Carthage College, talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the meaning of Foley's death and the reported ransom demand that preceded it.
Well, it underscores their brutality and lack of heart. They also need money to run an organization of this kind. And they are quite isolated. If there is any good news, very wealthy nations, in particular Saudi Arabia, but also Emirates and others who have been willing to fund radical organizations, don't seem to be willing to fund this one. So that's a plus. It also underscores the downside of the 24/7 news cycle, the pervasive electronic media. Even a ruthless and apparently, I believe, quite clearly demented organization like this one can get global news very quickly just by being extraordinarily violent.
Well, and this also seems to show maybe a new reality of war zone journalism, that opposing sides no longer feel the need to have journalists tell their story. I mean, way back when, you know, you could have a brutal regime, but they still at their heart wanted to get their story out. But now with, you know, things like Twitter and basically instant access to the world, they don't need journalists anymore.
That's right. There's no more intermediaries. It does provide serious journalists and professional journalists with some important choices. Do you want to, in effect, publicize this organization by presenting their atrocities? Fox News has done so. Other news media have not. I do think judgment remains important in journalism, but you're quite right. The news institutions as intermediaries have faded. That gets into some profound issues we don't have time to discuss on the radio today, even public radio, but it's something we all should be thinking about.
And the war zone journalists themselves, it's always been a dangerous profession, but now today perhaps even more so.
It's always been dangerous to be a combat correspondent, and they deserve and get special respect. Edward R. Murrow and the Atlantic in Europe and Britain, especially during the Blitz in the darkest days of World War II, and also Ernie Pyle in the Pacific, who was killed by a Japanese sniper toward the end of the war. We know these names because they are distinctive figures. They communicated the horror of war. They also communicated well with the average person. Mr. Pyle was very much the GI's correspondent. That role remains, but you're quite right, Mitch. This revolutionary period of terrorism and a wide range of different groups, that means traditional battlefronts have faded.
What does the U.S. and frankly, what do other Western powers have to weigh as they consider direct military intervention in this area? And the area we're talking about is northern Syria and I guess it is southeastern Iraq.
Well, whether or not boots on the ground in the current pop vernacular will be productive or counterproductive, I do believe that in this part of the world, but also in others, that direct intervention by U.S. forces on the ground would be counterproductive. I understand the need to have – I certainly support using American air power to help battle ISIS. I do support putting special forces and advisors on the ground. I'm confident that they've been helping very directly in this battle against ISIS. But large numbers of our troops on the ground, in a very real sense, it's exactly what Osama bin Laden was hoping we would do.
There is, of course, no little irony in the fact that a year ago we were talking about whether Western powers should take direct military action against the Syrian government itself. And now it's the militants trying to overthrow the government that are seen as the threat.
there's been a basic inconsistency to American foreign policy. You make an extremely important point. We've been favoring the opposition to the Assad regime in Syria. We have been opposing many of the same people in Iraq and parts of Lebanon and elsewhere. ISIS is a shorthand term for what is itself a rather mixed constellation of rebels and radicals. We can't indefinitely have such an inconsistent policy, and I think the fact that we're facing reality in terms of the need to work with Assad in Syria, I think that's positive. I'm not praising the regime. I'm not even forgiving their various serious sins, but we have to deal with the people who are in power who will be most helpful to furthering our own national interests and the interests of peace-loving nations generally in the world.
This is a be careful what you wish for sort of situation?
Yes, I think that's right. Assad is proving to be much, much more formidable and much more durable. This is a very tough Syrian military than we, meaning the Obama administration, initially obviously anticipated. But it is a very durable and tough regime. It has been useful to us in the past in terms of our national interest and the collective interest. They supported the UN and the U.S.-led alliance in the first Gulf War, for example.
Another major international story right now is the continued Ebola outbreak in Africa and the West's efforts to help the countries most affected by it. One development that some say might be doing more harm than good is the closure of borders and the cancellation of flights by some countries concerned the disease could spread to their country. Mm-hmm. On one hand, it's made it harder for health workers to get into the countries that are affected to help. But on the other hand, it's easy to understand the concern of these neighboring countries.
I think we should make a distinction between commercial activity, including commercial air travel, which has, of course, become pervasive in our globalized world, and the voluntary decisions, by and large, of specialists, aid workers, relief, medical personnel who can do some good. These people understand the risks of putting their life on the line. This disease is a terrible disease, but my understanding is that it's not all that readily communicated. And I don't think it's at all inconsistent for health workers to be there at the same time that commercial interests, especially commercial airliners, are steering clear of the area. I think both they complement one another in terms of making spread of this terrible disease less likely.
But I wonder if it does speak to some difficulty, the reality of trying to limit some kinds of travel while not limiting other kinds.
Well, we'll see how this unfolds. Yes, you're quite right. Where people travel readily around the world, it means that diseases of all kinds, not just this particular scourge, are more readily communicated. And there were predictions, I think, in the 1980s and 90s, more than today, that all kinds of diseases would be spread much more readily as people traveled much more actively. That actually has not happened. You mentioned off the air the terrible 1918 flu pandemic.
Right. It's a comparison that some are making.
Yes. It shows in many ways how much progress the world has made. Only approximately a century ago, any kind of serious disease was much more easily spread. Epidemics, plagues, pandemics until the 20th century were very much part of the human condition. We've collectively gotten away from that, and that's something to keep in mind, especially when reading scare headlines about Ebola or other serious health maladies.
Right. On one hand, we do travel much more collectively as the world, but at the same time, we know a lot more about the way diseases work.
Yes, that's right. It's much easier to limit these scourges, and through time, diseases have traveled not just through direct human contact, but through air, through water. Overall, the world is much healthier, much safer, much cleaner, especially our water supply, than was the case until fairly recent decades.
We haven't talked much about Asia in recent days. What are the defining stories that are coming from that part of the world today?
Well, China is increasingly assertive in military terms. There's now a whole range of maritime conflicts with Japan, most prominently, but also South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, Vietnam. There's also some dramatic evidence within the last week that the Beijing regime is cracking down much more on public activities of which they disapprove. There's an independent film festival that was just shut down completely in Beijing. A much more conventional, safe international film festival was held in Beijing in April. And, of course, they recently had the Olympics, and they take pride in various public extravaganzas. To shut down this film festival I think, first of all, it's a big mistake in every way for the still communist government, but it also shows that there are hardliners who seem to be more influential now than in the past.
Well, and would you imagine, does this speak to a fundamental insecurity about the stability of their own regime?
I think so. They're trying to maneuver a very complicated and difficult path. They're trying to open economically at the same time that they maintain relatively tight political control. The old Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev could not carry that off. Their efforts to open up led to their collapse. And I believe the leaders in Beijing are very mindful of this. It's also a relatively younger crowd in charge. There are youth in their 50s and 60s, even their 40s, who are running things, the much older regime. And I hope it's not just because I'm getting older. The much older regime, personified by the charismatic Deng Xiaoping, who opened things up in 1992 dramatically and started this process, it seems to me they were much more moderate and cautious in what they did.
Art Sear, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mitch. I enjoyed it.
Art Sear is professor of political economy and world business and the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our regular foreign policy contributor as well, and he spoke with Mitch Teich. We'll take a short break now, and then we'll have the second part of our roundtable discussion on race relations in Milwaukee, convened in the aftermath of the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Lake Effect returns with that conversation right after this.